Good evening and welcome to our live broadcast. Today we are continuing with the Anguttara Nikaya. Where to go? I'm just going to go right to the next one because it's not terribly deep, but it's interesting for those wondering about the role the heavens play in Buddhism. So apologies that this isn't a deep meditation teaching. I don't have any meditators here right now, so we're just going to go on from number 36 to number 37. So apparently in Buddhism, the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddha described various levels of angels. So there are Bhuma Deva, which are angels that live on earth, apparently. They live in trees or wherever they delight in, you know, the fairies, I guess we normally think of them as. And then there are the successively higher planes of angels. There are the four great kings that, if you maybe recognize some of you this from Chinese mythology, which gets it from Buddhism. The four great kings that look after the four directions. So apparently there are four angels who also are involved with the earth, but they take care of the four quadrants of the earth. I mean, directions doesn't really work because the earth is round, so I don't quite understand it, but there are apparently four great kings. And they report to the angels of the Dabodingsa, which is the next level. And Dabodingsa is, I guess, the highest angel realm that's directly interested in the earth. So Dabodingsa, Daba means 3, and Dingsa means 30. So it's the heaven of the 33. And it's called that because there were these 33 companions who went to heaven together, and they're led by Sakka. Sakka is the king of the angels of the 33. And so I guess a group of angels who live in their own realm, but somehow take an interest in the earth. And so the four great kings report to them. Four great kings are responsible for making sure that everything on earth is, I guess, going according to whatever divine plan that they have. If all this sounds fairly theistic or deistic, well, I suppose you could call it deistic, although I'm not even sure quite what that word means. But there is a sense of that in the time of the Buddha, people were obviously worshipping these angels, and so the Buddha was acknowledging the existence of such angels. But what he denied was the efficacy of prayer, or the importance of prayer. That sure, you could pray and beseech the gods for blessings or for mercy or so on, but there's no reason to think that they would comply, nor is there any benefit or any spiritual benefit to such activities. No. They certainly didn't have the power to enlighten one or to bring the highest benefit. And I guess that's really where Buddhism goes beyond a theistic religion. It's it doesn't deny the fact that angels can and you know, what you might call gods can potentially help human beings. It's not even the point to suggest that God can't move mountains, as they say in Christianity, which And anyway, it's that moving mountains wouldn't really help you. If you pray to God and God were to answer all of your prayers, still wouldn't mean much, because, well, the prayers that God can't answer are, may I become enlightened, may I be free from suffering, may I be free from greed, anger, and delusion, may I become a better person. It just can't happen. It doesn't come from the grace of God. And the grace of God, sure, maybe you could get rich, you could live in luxury, but you couldn't go to heaven. God doesn't have the power to bring someone to heaven or prevent them from entering heaven, nor does any god or angel have the power to send someone to hell. With some qualification, because of course beings can affect other beings, but the ultimate power comes from within. If your mind is pure, no one can send you to hell. But if your mind is impure, it's possible to instigate, and it's certainly possible that angels could manipulate you and trick you and into doing deeds that would send you to hell, or manipulate a person into sending them to heaven. So, I mean, it just means that there's an acknowledgement, whether you believe this or not, that there are certain beings that are not qualitatively different from human beings, in the sense that they still have defilements, and they still have lifespans, and they are still limited to affecting the physical realm. They can't actually manipulate another person's mind, not directly. But at any rate, there is some order to the angel realms, if for those of you who are interested and curious about these things. What's interesting about this sutta, and what really makes it Buddhist, because obviously talking about angels isn't particularly Buddhist, is that Sakya is a Buddhist. The king of the gods of the 33 is a follower of the Buddha, and they're concerned about the activities of human beings, the goodness of human beings. It's a group, and it's not to say that all angels will be like this, but this group of angels particularly is concerned as to whether human beings are honoring religious people, honoring elders, behaving properly towards their father and mother, whether they are keeping holy days in the sense of having religious observances, spiritual practice at least once a week, and doing good deeds. Are they giving charity? Are they keeping morality? Are they practicing meditation? But it's kind of funny why they're interested in this, and somewhat self-serving or pragmatic, I guess. They're concerned with this because they say to them, if the four great kings report to them that human beings are doing all these things, then they get really happy, because they say, oh, that means, that's great. That means there will be more angels in the future. It means there will be more of them. More people coming, and will have a greater retinue, will become, it's actually somewhat of a base desire to swell their ranks. And if they find out that people are doing bad things and not doing good things, then they're sad, because there won't be as many angels in the future. I mean, for us, it simply means it's a reminder that the only way to go to heaven really is to be a good person, is to have a pure mind. And all of that comes through doing good deeds, being good to other people, being respectful to other people, being kind, having a pure mind, not having ulterior motives or a crooked, treacherous mind, not being obsessed with base desires or hatred or aversion or grudges or that kind of thing. If your mind can stay pure in this defiled world, then and only then can you free yourself from it, from the coarseness, from the baseness, from the mundane, to enter into something more pure, more peaceful, more sublime. And then there's something funny that Sakka, the king of the angels, reminds the angels. He says, the person who would be like me should basically do lots of good deeds. The person who would be like me should keep the holy day, he says. Keep the Uposatha, which means this day where people keep the 8 precepts. And the Buddha says, you know, when he said this, it wasn't well said. It wasn't a proper verse to say. Not because it's not good to keep the religious precepts or to practice goodness and that kind of thing, but because Sakka, you know, no one should strive to be like Sakka, because Sakka is still not devoid of lust, hatred, and delusion. And he says, but I say the same thing. A person who would be like me should observe all of these things, because a bhikkhu who has become an arahant, someone who has become enlightened, not just the Buddha, but anyone who has become enlightened, should therefore say, the person who would be like me, and it is fitting. So, I mean, this kind of puts angels in their place, and it's really how, as Buddhists, we look at the world. We don't see angels. Most people will live their lives never having any evidence that these beings exist, but insofar as you might think that they do exist, they're still subject to the same laws and regulations of the universe, that goodness is what leads to heaven, and evil is what leads to hell. These beings don't have the power to make people better people, but they're happy to know that people do. They rejoice, as all good people should. We'd rejoice when we see more people meditating. It means there'll be more meditators. It's in fact not a terribly bad thing to think, because it makes our practice easier. Makes it easier to do good deeds when other people are keen on good deeds. When everyone's doing unwholesome deeds and obsessed with defilements, it becomes more difficult to do good things, because you get sucked, you get drained by the negativity of others. Anyway. So that's a little bit of Dhamma for today anyway. I was working, anyway. That's all about that. Do we have any questions?
We do, Bhante.
We're just talking about, I should mention it first. Just a reminder to people that we may have young people coming on this site, and any sort of adult conversation about sexual intercourse or other things, I guess drugs, alcohol, should be moderated or moderate, tempered. So just be mindful of where we are and the fact that we're not all of age. So not that anything inappropriate has been done or said, but just a reminder that keep it PG, or there's potential problems with talking about such things to people who are potentially underage. Okay, that's all.
Okay. In Practical Insight Meditation, Mahasi Sayadaw talks about reflecting on certain things, but to also notice reflecting, to keep it to a minimum. But you seem to be saying it's not necessary to think or reflect at all during meditation, and it's only necessary to teach, etc. So are you disagreeing with him, or am I missing something? And how is it possible to garner insight without reflecting on your experience?
I don't think I said that it's not, like, reflection has a place in terms of stepping back and reflecting on the quality of your practice. But the only benefit there is to adjust your practice. If your practice is going fine, I can see there's no benefit to reflecting on things that you've learned. Certainly reflecting is natural, but it's something you should be mindful of. But it's not the practice. And I mean, read what the Mahasi Sayadaw says about what we call jnana. Jnana is one of the 10 upakilesa. When your knowledge, the knowledge is that you gain when you become obsessed with it, fixated on it, when you start thinking about it, that's actually to the detriment of your practice. So the question about how could insight arise if you don't reflect, that's not what insight is. Insight is a direct realization of things. It's not reflection. When you see that things are arising and ceasing, that's insight. And the more you see that, the closer you'll get to letting go. Once you see it clearly, you'll just have kind of like an epiphany where not even a thought, but it's just an observation that everything that arises ceases and there's nothing worth clinging to, and then the mind lets go. There's no place in there for reflection. I think it's a misunderstanding of what insight is. Insight is not a thought. Insight is actually vipassana. Passana means seeing. Vip means clearly, or specially, or whatever, however you want to translate. Vip really means with wisdom, with panya. Panya actually just means panya, knowledge, complete. You know, when you know that this is rising, when you know that this is falling, that's actually wisdom. When you see it arising and ceasing, that's wisdom. That's all you need. I don't think Mahasi Sayadaw suggests otherwise, but you'd probably read the Burmese or be sure that it was properly translated, and then you have to understand that, you know, he generally makes allowances. You know, if he's actually advising people to stop and reflect, then I'd be quite surprised. But on the other hand, there is an advice for stepping back and reflecting insofar as it helps you see whether your practice is correct, whether you're actually doing things properly, and reflect on whether you're adequately, you know, whether you're missing something or whether something could be adjusted. That's called vimangsa. It's one of the four iddhipada, one of the four roads to success.
Between a sense of apathy versus an impartial stance towards something. Thank you.
I don't know. I mean, they're just words. You'd have to see what the actual state was. Someone who says, "I don't care." I mean, it sounds like it actually exists, but it's just words, and it's just a view, and it's a lot of ego in the sense of I am above that kind of thing. But they're just words. I mean, when an experience occurs, are you actually unreactive towards it? Because such people actually, when they are presented with something that does affect them, they react. I mean, that's really the point, is not everyone is reactive towards everything. For some people, some things are not going to create a reaction. But that's, you know, it's not a sign that they are apathetic. It's just a sign that that thing doesn't create, it doesn't have any kind of history with that person. So, you know, for some people, loud noise is obnoxious. Here in the West, if your neighbors are having a party, you get quite upset. In Asia, if your neighbors are having a party, people don't even seem to hear it. It's quite interesting to see some of the differences from culture to culture, the sort of things that bother people from different cultures. A general sense of apathy. I mean, there can be a delusion. Delusion is generally associated with equanimity, and I guess that's really the technical answer, is that the question is whether it's associated with delusion. But the delusion would be kind of this distracted thought. If a person is engaged in mental fomentation, if they're thinking about things and pondering and wondering and confused and that kind of thing, that's delusion, and there's equanimity with it. And then there's the wholesome kind, is with equanimity one does something good, or one cultivates wholesomeness in the mind through meditation. But the equanimity, you know, I guess the point is the equanimity is the same, but it's nothing to do with the equanimity, it's the delusion. Whether in the mind there's ego, or there's confusion, or there's mental distraction. Whether the mind is clear, or whether the mind is clouded.
Is there any point being grateful? Karma is going to manifest anyways, good or bad. How should we include gratitude in our practice?
Absolutely. I mean, that's not a good outlook. And you think, okay, I shouldn't be grateful because that person's going to get what's coming to them anyway. Who cares? Who cares whether they get what's coming to them or not? That's not the point. Gratitude is a wonderful state of mind. Gratitude is, we don't worry about other people. We're not grateful so that it helps the other person. We're grateful so that we don't become mean and terrible people who have no sense of appreciation for the good deeds of others. Gratitude is something that should come naturally, and if you find yourself ungrateful or unmindful of the good deeds of others, you should note that and try to understand why. Is it because I'm selfish or self-absorbed? It's generally based and due to either one of the two, a strong sense of greed and or a strong delusion. Being self-absorbed and or, you know, it can also come from anger, I suppose, if you're totally obsessed with your own suffering, so that when people help you, you just fix and focus on your own problems and how your own problems are solved or not solved, rather than thinking about the person who helped you. Gratitude is most apparent in those who have the least attachment, those who are least concerned about their own well-being, right? The people who are most able to appreciate the good things in others are those who have good things in themselves, are those who aren't concerned about their own good things, in the sense that they don't have feelings of guilt or worry. But people who have lots of unpleasant things inside tend to be too self-absorbed, worried about their own well-being, concerned and greedy, or angry and frustrated and upset and deluded and conceited. You can see how all of those things get in the way of gratitude. So when all of those gone, it's very easy to appreciate the good things in others. You're able to be mindful of the truth, and that's that this person helped you. I wouldn't try to cultivate it too much. I'd just be more aware as to whether you have it or not. And if you don't have it, there's a sign. It's a sign that you've got something blocking it.
Change the live broadcast to a different time? Is there someone else who would want that?
That's a good question. I can change it to another time. This time happens to be fairly convenient for me. Won't be convenient on Mondays soon, but apart from that, I can't think of a better time for me. I could do it early afternoon, but that would probably be a bad choice for most of our viewers since most of our viewers are in North America, which I know doesn't really help those of you who are in Europe, but if you look at the meditation list, the majority are USA, a few Canada, and then India and Europe, and we got a bunch of Mexico as well. Which, I mean, the question is, what is the cause, what is the effect, whether it's, because we're broadcasting in the evening or not. Right, that could just be because of the time. Obviously, Europeans aren't going to be on much anymore, except for Ruslan. Ruslan.
I just read down a little bit. It was because the person often had some follow-up questions to ask during the live broadcast, but decided that he would be patient and use it as a practice. Or you could get really fancy Monday and have Tuesday and Thursdays early and Monday, Wednesday, Friday at the normal time. And
I can't even keep track of my schedule as it is. I don't know which day it is most days.
keeping it simple is good too. Monday, during my last meditation session, it suddenly felt like my legs were not covered by my skin. The legs still felt like mine, but not the skin. It was sickening to my stomach. Am I still practicing right?
Well, that's not practice, you see. That's experience. The practice is how you relate to that experience. Be very clear that these are two distinct things. What you experience and what arises based on your practice is not the practice. Whether it be knowledge, or whether it be strange experiences like this, or even whether it be unpleasant experiences, defilements, if anger arises, that's not the practice. It's not like, oh, I'm very angry, I must be doing something wrong. No. Anger is an experience. It's a reaction. It is a bad thing, but don't worry about that. That's not your concern. It happened. Your concern is what you're going to do about it. So when you have this experience, how are you going to react to it? The fact that you're disgusted is potentially problematic because there's aversion, disliking. So that's not the proper reaction. But now that that's happened, you should say disliking, disliking, or disgusted, disgusted. Disliking is probably better. If you're just aware of it, then you would say knowing, or aware, or something. If it's a feeling, you might say feeling. Then that's the practice. Then you see, it comes and it goes. I think the problem is its practice is terribly unremarkable. The practice itself is too simple. It's unremarkable. That's it. You just say, thinking, seeing, feeling, angry. But it's made up for the fact that when you do that, there's fireworks. The things that you're observing are incredibly interesting. And there's a real transformation that goes on. So be clear that the practice is incredibly simple. There's not much to it. But the experiences that you're going to have are diverse and varied. Terribly exciting, if you let them be, which of course you shouldn't. You should be mindful of.
Bhante, during eating meditation, is it best practice to always keep the eyes open, or can the eyes be closed while chewing and swallowing?
They certainly can be closed while chewing and swallowing. There's no rule, hard or fast, but if you're really keen on it, closing your eyes is a good thing. Lets you focus more on the mouth and the throat. tastes and so on.
Will the current Android app still be working when the new cycle's live?
No. No, we probably could make it work if someone wanted to make a better Android app, that'd be great, but on the other hand, it might be nice just to use the website as it is, because then we only have to work on one thing. But the new site looks a lot like the Android app, if you've seen it. So yeah, give up the Android app once the new site goes live. Now there's an iOS app, apparently, but I think that might work. Let's see.
And you still can sign in to the regular site on a phone, so it's just a matter of wanting to be portable. You can still log your time in just through a regular browser on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Done that?
Well, yeah, the new site will look a lot like the Android app anyway. It won't be as hard to do. Like this one, you have to find the little button, but on the new one it'll be much more mobile friendly.
My sitting meditation is usually stressful and it seems to be getting worse.
Mm.
It feels like I'm forcing myself to stay seated. Do I just continue to work through it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a case where you might want to use Vimongsa, step back and reflect on what you might be doing wrong, what you might be missing. Not doing wrong exactly, but the aversion is what you should be meditating on. You know, if you feel stressed, then focus on the stress. It's not easy, and this is where the fireworks happen. This is where this simple technique does a number on you. It really messes with you, you know, it challenges you. It's called, you know, it sounds like probably, or not probably, you know, from the sounds of it, you're doing fine because you're cultivating patience. If it feels like you're forcing, then it's not that you're forcing, it's that you're missing something, that you're not actually being mindful of the aversion. Try and be as mindful of the aversion as you can, as quick. Catch what's really happening, because there's no such thing as meditation. You don't have sitting meditation, it doesn't exist. What happens when you sit down and close your eyes and then you watch the stomach now? The tendency probably is to try and force the stomach to rise and fall, which is an interesting thing. It's an interesting fact that your mind is, you know, if this is the case, that your mind is doing that. You know, the things that our mind does is what we're interested in. We're interested to learn how the mind works, to learn about the good things and the bad things in the mind. What we're doing right, what we're doing wrong. It sounds like probably, like all of us, you're doing something wrong. So just keep watching and you'll slowly see, oh, I'm doing this all wrong. Boy, I should just stop that.
Can I do mindful meditation without mantras?
You can, but you'd have to find a different teacher and a different tradition. Because some people say that you shouldn't use mantras. In our tradition, we say you should, and it's actually important to use mantras. So not in our tradition, sorry. I mean, why would you want to, I guess is the question. Of course, I understand why people want to, but it just leaves you shaking your head because they're so beneficial. That's the most powerful thing we have, is this tool of reminding ourselves. They're the best meditation technique I can think of. People who don't use them are missing out and don't know what they're missing at all.
You're all caught up on questions Monday.
All right then. That's all for tonight. Thanks, Robin, for your help. Thanks, everyone, for coming out and for meditating and for your questions. Have a good night.
Thank you, Bhante. Good night.